and this is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. Daryl Rood was something less than an ideal parent to his daughter, Aiden. That was the opinion of high courts in the state of Michigan. He saw her only sporadically after her first year of life, and he spent a short amount of time in jail for abusing her mother, his former girlfriend, Lori Copps. When the state took away her children, it also terminated Daryl's parental rights. But the state appeals court and now the Supreme Court say this was done illegally. The courts say Daryl Rood was not appropriately involved in the process and that the family court in Mason County hastily concluded that he was unfit to be a parent, even though he is now the primary caregiver for another young child. During the next hour on Points North, we're going to be talking about parents' rights in the state of Michigan and balancing those with the rights of children. And right now, we're joined by Daryl Rood from Manistee. Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking time to talk to us.
No problem.
The Supreme Court was pretty clear in your case that you got something less than a fair shake through all this. I think the term the court used was that the process used to terminate your parental rights was sorely lacking. I wonder why you think you were treated the way you were.
Well, I believe that most of it had to do with the wishes of my daughter's mother. Even through the pregnancy of Aiden, she had made it clear that if we had ever split up or if I had ever left her, that she would do whatever she could to keep her from me.
And how do you think she was able to make that happen, at least at the trial court level?
Well, the stipulation that she gave to voluntarily give up her rights to her children were that to make sure that they terminated mine.
And why do you think the court went along with that? That doesn't seem like a stipulation she would have the power to make.
Well, it was a prominent family in Mason County that had originally turned my daughter over to DHS, and the family that is the foster care now, that are providing the foster care now, wished to adopt her, and they have the same last name as the gentleman doctor that turned my daughter over to foster care. So I believe it's one of his children that are wishing to adopt my daughter, and it's me, a person with a criminal record that had made a lot of mistakes in his life and, you know, tried to change stuff, that's fighting against a prominent family, and as in the beginning I lost, so I had to keep fighting.
And did you ever go along with the arguments? I mean, in your mind, did you ever go along with what was being concluded about you by the courts and social workers?
No. Any time I've tried to explain anything to the social worker, I was instantly cut off and was never allowed to explain my side of the story until recently, which was the day that the Supreme Court opinion came back, where the social worker actually listened to what I had to say to her. But since then, I still haven't been able to even get a hold of her on the phone, and she don't return my calls. So.
And I guess I ought to say here that the Department of Human Services we sent a detailed request to the department about the things we're going to talk about during this hour, and asking that they provide someone to account for the department's behavior in this case and other cases, some of these issues, and they declined to talk to us. Now, this case, it seems it's gotten a lot of attention in Ludington. I noticed that the Ludington Talks website, there's just a lot of people commenting on it. Did that surprise you that there was so much interest?
Kind of in a way, yes, but some of it started off, you know, as you've probably already read, where they supported, you know, me trying to gain custody of my daughter and wanting to be able to see her, and then some that only read one-sided documents and go off of those. They make the same conclusions of my life as the social services had.
You mean people in the community?
Yes. That's why I I was posting and responding to some of what they were saying, and I've concluded that I don't want to listen to it anymore. You know, I've been fighting for almost three years to be able to even see my daughter, and I'm kind of tired of listening to all the negativity from people who don't know what my life is like now. They only know what my life was like 4, 5, 6 years ago.
You're saying you were publicly defending yourself, like in these on these web forums, prior to the Supreme Court ruling on this?
No, after the Supreme Court hearing, the Supreme Court ruling was when I Googled myself on the internet and found out that there was actually people talking about my case.
And you're saying a number of folks have continued to take a dim view of you?
Yes, because they have no idea what my life is like now. They all know what my past life was years ago. I'm no longer on any probation. I haven't done drugs in over 3 years. I haven't even drank in over 3 years. And, you know, my life is family-oriented. It's no longer running around with my friends. I've cut all of my old friends out of my life. My only focus is my family, and that's all I want it to be.
And so now you'll have another chance to make this case in the same court?
Yes.
But
it goes back into the local court.
And these proceedings haven't started yet?
No, they haven't. I'm not sure when or what's going on. I had a review hearing on the 19th of March. And they're usually not scheduled, but every 3 months apart. But I'd really prefer not to wait the 3 months to be able to start at least supervised visitation with my daughter. You know, I know that I'm not going to just jump in and get custody of her, that it has to be a slow transition, you know, for her to be able to get to know me again and to be able to accept each other and to try to create and build a bond back with her again.
And how hopeful are you that this will work out in your favor this time around?
I hope it will. I mean, when the mother and I were together, my little girl was my life. I mean, and any argument that we got in was my daughter's life, and being able to know me or being able to be around me was always thrown in my face. That she'd be kept from me, that I wouldn't be able to see her. She would move to another state and put her up for adoption, that she'd put her up for adoption here in Michigan. And so I just went along and did whatever the mother wanted me to do, and to be able to keep being able to go over and see my daughter, or every now and then I'd be able to take her overnight and, you know, stuff like that. But I want this to come to an end and for my daughter to be able to come home and be with her family, her real family. You know, I have nothing against the foster family. I'm sure they're great people. But a child deserves to be raised with their real family, not to just be pushed off, especially when one of the parents are capable to raise the child. The child should not be pushed off into a foster home and raised by the state.
And as you said a few minutes ago, you feel that people continue to see you as who you were in the past.
Yes.
That seems like kind of the key element to all of this.
Yeah, that's what, and any of the forums or anything that I've read, that's what continuously gets brought up, is that his past, he did this, he did that. Well, you know, I don't do anything that I did in the past. My life has changed. I'm not that same person.
Well, Daryl Rood, we wish you and your daughter well, and we hope that the proceedings work out better this time.
So do I. I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay. All right, and enjoy the day.
All right, thank you.
That's Daryl Rood. His parental rights were terminated by a family court in Mason County, but earlier this month, the Michigan Supreme Court upheld the reversal of that decision, and he will again try and convince the trial court that he is a fit parent for his biological daughter, Aiden. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. It's Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. We're talking today about the rights of parents in Michigan and balancing those with the interests of children. The trial courts have come in for a bit of a drubbing in recent opinions, like Daryl Rood's case. In another recent case, the Supreme Court said the trial courts have shown a disturbing pattern of violating the right of poor people to have an attorney provided if they can't afford one. Back in January, an appeals panel said a court in Kalkaska had shown it couldn't be impartial in a parental rights case and remanded the case back to a different court. One widely respected probate judge is Kenneth Takema in Wexford County. He couldn't join us live this morning, so I spoke with him yesterday. I'd like to start with the Rood decision. As I understand it, the appeals court, when it overturned the decision of the trial court, did not publish its decision. So the Michigan Supreme Court could have just quietly declined to hear the case and left that ruling in place. Instead, it took up the case. It affirmed with about 65 pages of opinion. I wonder why you think it did so and what you think the effect of this ruling will be on these kinds of cases down the road.
Well, there's a compound question there. I'll start with why do I think that the Supreme Court did take it up? I have to believe that there was a desire for the Supreme Court to make a firm statement in a precedentially binding case to reinforce the message to not only the trial courts but the Department of Human Services and the attorneys that litigate these cases of the importance of the constitutional due process issues at stake in child protection cases. So yeah, I think that the case was taken up by the Supreme Court intentionally to make a statement to the whole child protection legal community.
And let me clarify what you mean. And so by firm statement, that is, I would distinguish that from an opportunity to clarify an area of the law that is confusing or has not been adequately decided.
Right. Correct. That's correct. The case did not involve any novel interpretations of a statutory question or any issues that I'm aware of were unsettled in terms of splits of authority within the courts of appeals or something like that, where the Supreme Court needed to make a statement to clarify law. I think that they wanted to make a more pointed statement with regard to the due process issues.
I think maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but I think most people in Michigan would assume that when they go into a trial court, they're dealing with, as a general rule, good judges who preside over courts with expertise and fairness. But, I got to say, in all this, you're telling me here's a very long decision basically stating the law, not offering clarifications of confused areas or dealing with a novel situation. And in other instances, there was another comment from the Supreme Court in a different, this was an order, not a ruling, saying they see a disturbing pattern emerging among the trial courts in that they are not appointing attorneys to indigent defendants in these cases, or they're not doing it in a timely way. What do you make of this? What's the problem?
Well, you know, there's a lot of layers that we could approach this on. Okay, you want to take the biggest canvas on which to paint, and you look at the whole area of termination of parental rights cases, and I happen to know this because it was required for some research I was doing a couple of years ago, or maybe I think it was about last year, about a year ago. Something like 98% of all termination of parental rights cases are affirmed on appeal. So what we're talking about is a really small slice of cases that are getting reversed, and like the Rood case and like the case in which you mentioned where counsel was not timely appointed. Those are really, in some sense, aberrations statistically within the whole world, the world of Michigan child protection law. Now, as to the Rood case itself, that case involved a number of problems, and when it's in black and white, it's hard to fault. It's hard not to criticize the procedures there and say that they were constitutionally inadequate as a matter of due process of law. But the interpretation of the facts can be different for the trial judge sitting there who's got a chance to see these witnesses and make a judgment on who's telling the truth and who's shading things. That doesn't detract from the accuracy of the decision of the Supreme Court here that the notice was constitutionally inadequate and the DHS did not give constitutionally adequate opportunity to this father to be involved in this case. But I am saying that on a case like Rood, some of these things are very fact-dependent. And overall, I can speak with some assurance because I've been in this now for 15 years in this particular little segment. Actually, longer than that, because when I was prosecuting an attorney, and before that, a public defender. So I've actually got 29 years of experience in this general area, and I can say with real assurance that this is not a systemic crisis as such. It may be. I think Rood is very good as a tune-up for the trial bench, just to give us a reminder, hey, be very careful about these things. Don't assume an absentee father really is just trying to avoid his legal and moral responsibility to a child. Get him in, get him served properly, force participation, and if they wash out, then you know. But don't allow Don't start with a mindset that if they don't show up because it means they have no interest in the child. So I think that is it a problem? Of course, we always want perfection. Is it a wide failing among the trial courts that handle these cases? I don't think so.
But when the Supreme Court says a disturbing pattern among the trial courts, I mean, I read that as they see this coming up in too many places too often.
Yeah, well, the appointment of counsel issue, and that was an issue, a small issue buried into the Rood case to some degree. Why didn't he get an attorney when he did show up in court the first time? Why wasn't an attorney appointed? And there, you know, then you get into some other issues, too, which get into the problems between the courts and the funding units. You know, the funding units for the trial courts in Michigan are the counties. Counties, I can say with assurance, counties do not like to pay public defender budgets. The courts, in my judgment, in a perfect world, the courts would have nothing to do with funding. This would not be a concern of courts at all, either for funding of public defenders, funding of child placement, or funding of child care costs through the child care funds and so forth. That all should be left in the executive branch of government, and just completely not something that the courts have to even have anything to do with. But the fact of the matter is, and the reality is that we do have to have something to do with that, and we do have to face boards of commissioners who are struggling with very scarce resources. So I think that the what the Supreme Court may be saying in the order in which you mentioned is don't let the commissioners bulldoze you on public defender budgets when due process issues are at stake.
I see. Now you've pointed out that people may be overlooking the fact that fairly recently Michigan has updated its law to deal with some problems that have existed in the child protection system. What changes have been made, and do you see things improving because of those amendments?
I do think that things will improve. The amendments were in some ways technical refinements to the law, but the fact of the matter is that those amendments were partly to address some of these very concerns about children being in foster care, being in placements for a long period of time without a permanency plan that would get them into something stable and hopefully long-lasting. And some of the changes that were made, one was a very technical issue with regard to the way that termination of parental rights may occur. Under Michigan's law, and incidentally, RUD was decided under the old law. The new law is just now, the new law took effect August 1 of last year, 2008. But those cases are just now starting to come up through the system, and by the time they get in under the new law, by the time they get into the Court of Appeals, it won't be till next year. So we're probably going to have at least a substantial period of time yet when cases will be decided under the old law. Interestingly, in my estimation, the case might have come out differently by the trial judge under the new law. And let me explain why that will be. In Michigan, to terminate a parent's parental rights, you have to do two things. You have to prove a statutory basis exists. That is there a provision of our statute that by clear and convincing evidence gives rise to legal grounds to terminate the parent's rights? Okay, that's the first inquiry. The second inquiry would used to be, under the old law, if that statutory basis was found, the court had to terminate parental rights unless there was a clear showing that it was not in the child's best interest. Now, the new law has changed. Now, under the new law, not only does the statutory basis have to be proved by clear and convincing evidence, also now the department has to prove that it is in the child's best interest to terminate parental rights. So it now puts that second prong, the burden of that second prong, firmly on the department to make those proofs. Whereas before, once they proved the statutory basis, unless the parent came back or unless there was some other evidence in the record, the judge had to terminate parental rights. But now the department has to prove both of those things. And so I think, it's highly speculative, but RUD might have even turned out different at the trial level under the new law. There were a number of different provisions in the new law, but the second big provision, which tries to consolidate child protection within the family, and has created a whole new type of guardianship called juvenile guardianships, so that if you have, as in the RUD case, where you have a mother who clearly was not amenable to rehabilitative services, the department now has an obligation to try and find some other family member or some other suitable person to act as a guardian for that child and create a juvenile guardianship. Now, in RUD, that probably, that was not an issue in RUD because the father was there and he wanted to take custody of his child. But that is the second big area that we have seen legislative change in, is the creation of the juvenile guardianships and the legislative policy to try and, as I say, keep it in the family, so to speak, without terminating parental rights.
Problems with a system may be rooted in laws, but when it's a statewide approach to a problem like a child being in jeopardy, then you might also develop kind of cultural practices or a culture within that system. Do you see problems that can't be addressed by changing the law that you would like to see worked on?
Well, there is... there are definitely different cultures in terms of child protection depending on where you are in the state. Some of that culture is set by the judge, the presiding judge of the family division that handles the cases in the area. Some of that culture is set by the local DHS offices. And the practices and procedures of the local office, and frankly, the kinds of work ethic that is put into the cases by different offices can vary from place to place a great deal. That was mentioned in Rood, incidentally, that the fact that there is a statewide policy manual and DHS receives training on that, all the workers receive that kind of training, doesn't mean that those policies are applied evenly and consistently throughout the state. There is a lot of local culture that still goes into this, and it's also a local culture of the individual trial judge. And the trial judge, different trial judges approach these cases in different ways. Which is permissible, there is enough latitude within the law to allow that kind of discretion. If you were to ask me personally, I would like to see more uniformity of practice, but that's very difficult to achieve. It's just difficult to achieve the same kind of culture on a real broad scale. You're going to have local legal and local social work cultures just because of the way the system is broken down by little geographical units.
Well, Judge Kenneth Takuma, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to chat about this. As I say, this is a very important issue in our culture now, because we do have so many kids that are in the child protection system at one level or another, and we do need to do better. We just all need to do better.
And Judge Kenneth Takuma is a probate judge in Wexford County. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette, and today we're talking about the rights of parents in the state of Michigan and how those are supposed to be balanced with the needs of children. You can join in our conversation this morning for the rest of the hour at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. I'm joined now by Elizabeth Warner. She's an attorney in Jackson. She did provide some legal consultation for Daryl Rood in his appeals of the decision out of Mason County. She joins us from the studios of Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Thanks for your time. As we just heard Judge Takuma say, there are many layers to this problem. As he sees it, it's not a systematic or a systemic problem or widespread. I think it's fair to say you and other attorneys do see it as that there are widespread problems. Could you, sort of in the broadest brushstrokes possible, kind of describe the nature of the problem you see?
Yes, I can, and I'm more than willing to do so. And I agree with Judge Takuma that the main problem is that we've got local cultures run by judges and the local DHS offices that aren't always in compliance with the very good laws we have on the books in Michigan. And I think the statistics bear this out. Look at Mason County, where the Rood case occurred. In 2007, all the local counties were required to report through their foster care review board what kinds of rates of reunification with parents that they had in those counties. And they took a snapshot of the kids that were in care temporarily, supposedly, and put in foster care. In 2007, Mason County ultimately only put 14% of those children with a parent. But in your nearby counties of Benzie and Grand Traverse in the same year when this snapshot was taken, temporary court wards were returned to a parent 100% of the time. In my county of Jackson, it's 88%. Mason County ranks at almost the very bottom. And the cultures are very strong, and I think they come from the personality and experiences of the local judges and social workers. They also happen because sometimes the local attorneys who are court-appointed for the parents and the children do not get actively involved in the case and investigate what the actual facts are, and are more inclined to rubber stamp the decisions of the social workers.
So, well, how is that a systemic problem then if it varies so much from county to county? Seems
well,
like your solutions would have to be local.
Well, it's been a systemic problem because until the last year, our appellate courts were not adequately reviewing these cases for the many procedural violations that are coming before them. And what we've seen is an upswing, and a dramatic upswing, in the number of reversals of trial court determination decisions in the last year and a half. And so what you saw from the Supreme Court this month were two very important cases to try and get them back on track. But that trend had already started in the Court of Appeals last year. I think what happened, either because maybe new appeal attorneys were coming before them, but it's also because of a few new judges on the court, that they're starting to realize that these very protective laws that are on the books were simply not being followed.
So we've talked about some of these during this hour so far, and we've discussed the issue of court-appointed attorneys, and in the Rood case, some of the presumptions that the court made there that the higher court said were illegitimate. I mean, what are the other violations you see happening somewhat commonly?
Well, in February of this year, a law professor from University of Michigan, Professor Vivek Sankaran, who's an expert on these cases, published an opinion piece that said he saw four corrections that needed to be made in the system to try and make it more family-friendly and to increase our very bad rate of reunification, which, by the way, is less than 40% statewide of children are reunified with their parents. That's abysmal, and it is nowhere close to what the states around us have. Well, interestingly enough, between February and April, thanks to the state Supreme Court getting actively involved, two of his concerns have been satisfied. At least the Supreme Court has told the trial courts and the social workers they better start complying with the law in those two areas. And so really only he only identified two more that need work. In my opinion, there's two problems with current state law and practice that if those were changed, we could make a dramatic impact in the numbers of children that ultimately have to stay in foster care. One of them is that our emergency removal laws need to be tightened up and made constitutional. As they are currently on the books, they are not constitutional and are simply, even in their current state, not complied with on a widespread basis. Social workers, sometimes roping poor, innocent police officers into it, go in and yank children out of the home without complying with the legal standards on the books, which need to be improved. And once a child is taken in an emergency removal, it is extremely difficult to get DHS or the court to let go of them and return them home. And the second major problem we have in Michigan that is almost unique to Michigan, only two states do this. There is a widespread practice in the state that is still approved by our Court of Appeals to deny the second parent in a family a trial on whether they're an unfit parent. So they will go in, remove the child from one or both parents, and if one parent will is got a problem and admits to that problem or has a trial and is found to have parental problems, they will take the child from the other parent too and put them under a bunch of onerous, time-consuming, and sometimes completely unnecessary programs that are very expensive, and will outright deny that parent a right to a jury trial to determine whether they are also an unfit parent.
Let's take up that first one a little more, the emergency removal law. What is the explanation for why Michigan has a law that gives more power to agencies to pull kids out of houses fairly quickly?
Well, I'm a civil rights attorney, so I guess I would say it's because they haven't been sued enough. frankly, that's how some of these changes get made. When they do these unconstitutional removals, they can be sued. It's one of the few areas of the law that the social workers do not have complete legal protection from lawsuits. And I think that needs to happen more often. I think we need to educate our police officers. They don't want to break the laws. In my opinion, in general, police officers in this state want to comply with their constitutional and legal obligations when they're good officers. I don't see that in the state social workers. They consider it all a policy matter, not a legal matter. And the other reason is the courts, right after the emergency removal, are required to have a hearing. Our laws don't have built into them that the court has to vigorously scrutinize whether that emergency removal was justified or not. And that's despite the fact, so they rubber stamp the social workers, and that's despite the fact that since 1982, the federal appeals court over our state has said that they have to give the parent a hearing before they remove the children, not afterwards, and everything except a situation that is such an emergency that the child could die imminently, immediately, or be seriously injured. They are supposed to first have a court hearing before they take the children. They don't do that anywhere in this state.
That is Elizabeth Warner. She's an attorney in Jackson, who practices in the area of family law. She did provide some legal consultation for Daryl Rood in his case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. You can join in our conversation at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. I should say again that we sent a detailed message to the Department of Human Services in Lansing explaining what we would be talking about this morning and requesting that they provide someone to talk with us about their policies and practices, and they declined. We'd love to hear from you if you work in this area of social work and have a comment or a question. We have a call right now. Jenny in Kingsley, good morning. Jenny, good morning.
Yep, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning. You already addressed pretty much what my point was about the systemic problem. It's a hard law to follow because it's such an individual situation. Each case has to be taken individually. But we are in the situation where we are grandparents. The parents of the child are fairly young. And so we have stepped in and we're raising her, but our son, still lives at home. The mom has pretty much abandoned her. She doesn't see her very often, and the only time she does see her is when the courts wanted her to pay some child support, and we told them that we didn't want her to do that. We didn't want her to have to be involved. She's a young parent of another child. They said that it wasn't up to us. That they wanted her to be accountable, so they had a small amount that she has to pay. But whenever that comes up, she threatens to take the baby back.
So, what is the problem with how this is working that you see as having relevance beyond just your situation?
I don't think that we as grandparents have much right in the situation like this. Although her daddy has full custody. And living in our home, so really he's the one the courts are addressing as the legal guardian, and which is fine. We're getting along just fine, but we can't address anything. We can't be in the courts whenever there's an issue. We're supposed to stay out of court, and so even though everybody, it's a wink, wink, nod, nod, it's okay for us to be raising the little one, we don't have any legal rights.
Elizabeth, you have any thoughts on that?
I'm sorry?
Yes. Well, this is obviously an example of a bad judge and a bad county and a bad DHS, and I'll tell you why. Yes, the people who are raising the child of a child who's in court custody,
mm-hmm.
whether they're grandparents or foster parents, do have a right to be involved in the process. They, in fact, it's mandatory that people get their opinions from them before each court hearing. If this grandparent, and this is if this is a state custody situation, she needs to find out who the foster care review board members are in her county and make a complaint. But probably the best place to go to make that complaint is to the Office of Children's Ombudsman in Lansing. They are the agency of our government that investigates DHS. They have a pretty high rate of validating that DHS violates their own laws and procedures at a 65% rate in the last year they looked at, 2006. Call them or communicate with them. They have a very good website, and you can get to that at michigan.gov/OCO, Office of Children's Ombudsman.
Okay, thank you. I'm so concerned about rocking the boat at all because I am afraid of somebody coming in and taking her, since we are the ones raising her.
And you have every right to be that way. Social workers are notoriously vindictive toward people who rock the boat. And that's why I suggest you get more legal clout on your line, on your side. The Foster Care Review Board is your advocate in the system. You can make a complaint to that board if you are raising this child on behalf of a court.
Okay.
And that
right,
is a
great.
Volunteer agency, and you can find out who they are by going to the DHS website, and there will be links on that to your county office. Within that link, you will find the names, addresses, and phone numbers of the three people in your county who are on the Foster Care Review Board.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jenny.
Super. Thank you.
Elizabeth Warner, as I understand it, agencies that are sometimes involved in these proceedings include private agencies that the state contracts with to handle foster care cases and adoption cases. Some people that I've been speaking with see this as a conflict of interest because these agencies would be paid if parental rights are terminated. They are then paid to arrange an adoption, and yet they can also have a role in termination procedures. What can you tell me about this issue?
What you've heard is completely accurate. I think that counties that don't have any of those private agencies are better able to comply with the reunification laws with the birth family at a much higher rate than where those agencies exist, because built into those agencies, they started out as adoption agencies. And then some time ago, probably before I even got to this state, they transitioned into also providing foster care services. So instead of having a state social worker supervise the case, although there is one on the paper, the actual supervision and dealing with the family is moved over to these private agencies. And one of the most unfortunate trends in this state, and I think that Judge Takama and other probate court judges agree with me on this, is that our legislature thinks they're going to save money by transitioning almost all of the foster care case supervision over to private agencies. Well, they do that. They're just going to increase the foster care budget because there'll be a lot more kids being adopted because there are financial incentives for these agencies to do the adoption. They get through the whole time the child is a minor. They keep getting paid for their successful adoptions.
But do they have a caseworker for a private agency that's handling a child protection case, that caseworker would have the same power as an employee of the Department of Human Services of Michigan?
Yes.
And
the courts listen to them.
But they're
and they can make up all kinds of things. What they do is they, and this is what social workers do, it's not so much that, like in the Rood case, the social worker actually lied about many things and the Supreme Court caught her on it and called her reports fictional. I call that lying, and where I come from in Texas, but they want to say fictional, be nice, and Midwestern, that's fine. But what happens with the private agencies and with some state social workers still is that they'll just put a label on it, like they'll call the parent uncooperative or unwilling they say they aren't benefiting from services, and the court-appointed attorneys and the judges don't ask the social worker to go underneath that and see if they got any facts to back it up. And used to be, the Court of Appeals would just see a record like that, see a transcript like that, and they'd affirm the termination. Now they're starting to look underneath to see if there's any facts to back it up. So for the first time really ever, we're getting a large amount of appeals courts overturning these cases on the facts. They're going underneath what the label is and finding out if there's really any meat to it.
And how do you account for that happening now, this large number of
some of it's
reversals?
All the legal changes that Judge Takuma referred to, but I think it's just new people on the Court of Appeals that got interested in these cases and are informing their colleagues about the constitutional rights involved in particular. And I think instead of just looking at a brief, for example, it used to be the prosecution would file a brief, the prosecutor's offices represent DHS in these cases, and they would do the list of horribles of how awful this parent is. They would do the kind of character assassination that's still being done on Daryl Rood. And the courts wouldn't look beyond that, and they'd affirm the termination. Because the parent's brief might be weak, the court-appointed appellate attorney might not know much about the case, isn't getting paid very much, and maybe just has gotten so disillusioned that he's got any hope for reversal, they just don't write a very effective brief. But now the courts are starting to investigate cases on their own, and I think they're finding the emperor has no clothes in a lot of these parental termination cases.
Another general complaint that I've been hearing is that once there's a case and social workers are involved, then there are certain criteria that are used to determine if a family can be reunited. And the example that has come up a number of times is in some instances families have been told that it's not okay to have children in one bedroom, that I guess every child has to have his or her own bedroom. Who decides what criteria is legitimate to use in a situation like this, and what is that based on?
The individual judges in the trial courts decided, and that goes back to what Judge Takuma said. DHS recommendations for a laundry list of things the parent has to do to get the child back is regulated totally by the trial judge. And if he doesn't have real vigorous advocates for the parents and the children in his courtroom to dispute DHS, it gets rubber stamped. And these parents are running around being told they have to have a job when the DHS laundry list that's been approved by a judge with no vigorous opposition from the attorneys takes up all their time. How are they supposed to work if they're going and running everywhere for appointments that maybe they don't even need?
So, but what are those? I mean, what is a judge supposed to use to determine which criteria are? Is it stated in laws or is it stated in rules?
No, it's stated in the Constitution. You just see if the home's safe. That's it. Period. No erasers. The kid's supposed to go back. We're not in the business here of funding foster homes or providing adopted families just because those people may have more financial resources in the family of birth. As long as the children have a loving, safe, minimally safe home, they're supposed to go back. And that's something that the Supreme Court emphasized and the Court of Appeals emphasized in both the Rood case and the other case that was decided a week later, is that we're not looking for model parents here. And that's not a Michigan law. That's a United States Constitution law. And until our court system and our social workers quit trying to make these poor parents into middle-class icons of virtue, we're going to continue to have the problem. All we care about is the kid going to be abused or neglected when they come home, and living, you know, families living in one room doesn't mean that you're abusive or neglectful, but I bet you most of the social workers in the state would think so.
And I think one of the defenses that would be used on the part of the Department of Human Services would be it's better to err on the side of being overzealous in protection of children rather than to err the other direction. What do you think of that?
Well, whoever told you that's right, that is the rule, but that's not the legal rule. The legal rule is you err on the side of presuming that the parents are doing a good job. And that has been a fixture of our constitutional law throughout the last half of the 20th century, and it's still being enforced regularly. I understand DHS is in a bind. They get criticized when they overreact and take kids that shouldn't be taken from their family, and they get criticized when they underreact and leave them in bad foster homes or bad families, and the kids get seriously injured or die. And that's the problem. I've never been able to understand why police seem to be able to make those decisions much more accurately, and social workers are always under criticized for overreacting or underreacting. I have a bias here, obviously, in favor of law enforcement, but because I was a prosecutor and my husband's a retired police detective, but because I do believe they try harder and they have common sense. I just think a lot of social workers just lack fundamental common sense, frankly. They're not evil. They just come from the social work field.
Okay, I'm going to bring in a caller real quick. We just have a minute left. Dan in Rapid City. And he is gone. So, we just have about 1 minute left. One other issue I wanted to ask you about that was brought to my attention is that some people perceive that the problems you're describing aggravate domestic violence because mothers are perhaps reticent to report being abused for fear of then ending up in the child protection system. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, another genuine problem is that one, and one like it is when you have a sexual abuse problem in the family. Again, DHS workers, heaven knows why they do this, take out against the innocent mother when she finally leaves the family and they find out she's in a shelter, and some shelter or maybe sometimes a police officer reports a domestic violence case to CPS, and frankly, they don't go after the perpetrator nearly as strongly as they go after the mother. There are mothers who's losing their rights all the time now because they're the victim of domestic violence and their child's been the victim of sexual abuse because social workers just have a skewed view of the world. One of those cases just got reversed by the Court of Appeals a couple of weeks ago where they went after a mother in an incest case. Man, she's not the perpetrator. The guy was. And she was dealing with a difficult situation, maybe not perfectly, and the Court of Appeals reversed the termination of her parental rights.
All right, that's Elizabeth Warner. She's a civil rights attorney in Jackson. She joined us from the studios of Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. Elizabeth, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having this program. It's very important.
Enjoy your weekend. This has been Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks to Charlie Stone, who helped me produce the show. John Wunsch provided our theme music. Jack Connors is our engineer. Tom Paulson is the general manager of Interlochen Public Radio.